Tov. Okay, I hope everyone had a wonderful Hanukkah. Just wanted to say at the beginning of the class, somebody had asked me about getting the text of Halachic Man, that it's not available in stores. It's worthwhile to get, but one could get it on Amazon. So,
Amazon has used
ones also. Yeah, so Amazon, that's the best source for Jewish books these days. Okay, we're up to footnote 4. We skipped it in order to be able to understand the flow of the paragraph from page 4. And it's time to go back to footnote 4. Footnote 4 is the longest footnote in the book, and it's also the most astounding, both in its content and its form and the poetry in it. And it's going to put together the end of the issue that we've been speaking about for the past month, really. And then we're going to go on to chapter 2. So you know that footnote 4, if you look again in page 4, is coming as a footnote of the whole idea that Rav Soloveitchik has been speaking about, which is the creative power embedded within antithesis, meaning that the personality of halachic man, the personality of the religious person that is constantly inundated with struggle, that conflict itself is what brings about growth and brings about the beauty and the grandeur of soul that can only be reached by a person that goes through that struggle and that strife that a halachic man has to go through. And we spoke about that at great length. We're not going to get into now how Hegel's philosophy, the dialectic principle, how it's then brought about and expressed in other religious philosophies, and how Judaism speaks about it. That's what we've been speaking about for the past couple of weeks. Footnote 5 we already did. Footnote 5 is where Soloveitchik spoke about, if you remember, if you look on page 143, footnote 5 is where he brought the Shnei Ksuvim Baim Machishim Zedze, the two verses that contradict each other, until you have the third harmonizing verse that brings them together, the story of the Akedah, etc. Footnote 4 is a very long footnote, which we're going to read now together. Anyone that was here in Esh Kodesh about 15 years ago, Rav Weinberger gave a whole Shabbos Shuvah drasha based on this footnote. So if anyone remembers it from back then, I apologize if it's going to sound redundant. But it's always good to review, especially after 15 years. Take a look on page 139. So the very beginning of the footnote, we spoke about already, how Rav Soloveitchik says how Kierkegaard, even though he disagreed with Hegel's philosophy, which was about objectifying all of humanity, speaking about how all of the human condition and all of human experience and all the sciences can essentially be narrowed down to a nice, neat little philosophy, that Kierkegaard couldn't stand. If you remember, we spoke about that 2 weeks ago. So he disagreed with Hegel's philosophy of, so to speak, putting all of reality into a nice, neat little package. And he made it the object of his fierce, stinging attacks. He nevertheless accepted from him the dialectical principle. We spoke about, if you remember, the three stages of man: aesthetic stage, ethical stage, and then religious stage. And this concept of the dialectic, which he and Barth introduced into the analysis of the unfolding of the religious consciousness, and this view concerning the antinomic structure of religious experience, which was revised and refined by Rudolf Otto in his book, The Idea of the Holy. So essentially, we spoke about Otto, the idea of the holy other, how God is the mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery, completely other, and that only by really understanding this gap, this chasm that lies between man and God, can one hope to then reach the synthesis of that, which is then to be able to bridge that gap and to synthesize oneself with God. That's only after understanding that huge gap that lies between one and God. That's what Otto speaks about in the idea of the holy. That's what Kierkegaard speaks about in his philosophy. And we spoke about how Judaism has a take on that idea. Now, based on all of that, all of this, how in the religious philosophers, Otto, Barth, Kierkegaard, how in Judaism, how we speak about it, we spoke about it the past few weeks. Now Rav Soloveitchik goes on you'll forgive me for saying it like this, but a temper tantrum. And he's very mad at the way that a lot of superficial people look at religion. Let's see inside. This whole approach, two lines from the bottom, this whole understanding of the dialectical principle inherent in any religious person's consciousness, give the lie to the position that is prevalent nowadays in religious circles, whether in Protestant groups or in American Reform and Conservative Judaism. He's going to have a temper tantrum and he's going to attack, give the lie, so to reveal the falsity, the untruthfulness, the lie that's inherent in that's prevalent in religious circles. And Rav Soloveitchik points out, particularly Protestant groups and American Reform and Conservative Judaism. Now, before we get into that, I need to make a little parenthetical note over here, which I'll expound on later. I don't know what's going on in Protestant groups these days. I haven't been hanging out in them, you know, recently. But I could tell you one, not I've been hanging out with a Reform and Conservative either. But I could say things, one thing, and I think it's very important to say. First of all, hope nobody's going to stone me. No one has stones over here, right? American Reform and Conservative Judaism has changed a lot since the past 60 years that Rav Soloveitchik wrote this book. And therefore, what he's saying over here would not be a correct stereotype to speak about today Reform and Conservative Judaism, as I will explain later on. It's gone through a lot of transitions, as much as we could say positive transitions in some ways also. It would not be true to say what he's saying over here. The opposite, on the other hand, I could tell you that there are a lot of Orthodox Jewish circles that one could say what Rav Soloveitchik is going to say over here. And I'll elaborate on that also later on. So to speak, the point that I'm just trying to say is that this stereotype we should not feel that we're exempt from it. And it's very important to know that it should not be boxed into any particular group. All Jews have to know whether or not we could call up, or we have this problem with ourselves or not. What is this lie? What is this falsehood? What is this stereotype that's found in certain groups? That the religious experience is of a very simple nature. This is a position that certain religious groups, again, Rav Soloveitchik says in his time was Reform and Conservative. I tend to think that it's found in a lot of Orthodox groups today. What is this stereotype? What is this falsehood? What is this lie, this prejudice? That the religious experience is of a very simple nature. That is, devoid of the spiritual tortuousness present in the secular cultural consciousness, of psychic upheavals and of the pangs and torments that are inextricably and connected with the development and refinement of man's spiritual personality. In other words, in the secular world, it's known, it's understood, it's accepted that in order to refine man's spiritual personality, in order to reach growth, one must go through torments and spiritual torments, one must go through pangs and upheavals, one has to work on oneself to reach a state of refinement. That's the secular bend, the secular look. On the other hand, the prejudice is that religiousness is opposite, is a very simple nature. This popular ideology contends that the religious experience is tranquil and neatly ordered, tender and delicate. It is an enchanted stream for embittered souls and still waters for troubled spirits. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, that religion is a refuge, a halfway house, right? Religion is where one runs if one is, you know, weary and tired, huddled masses yearning to breathe free, right? And one has a soul that's been suffering and is bitter. So you run to religion. Religion is that place, that bastion of simplicity that one runs to when things are not going well. I have to tell you, I'm going to speak about it more later on, but I have a pet peeve. You know what a pet peeve is? Everyone knows what a pet peeve is, right? One thing that makes me nuts. And that is when people use as a proof for religion, and I mean a lot of religious people too. As I said, unfortunately, very often it's religious people that do this. when they go through all sorts of proofs, you know, today, especially in the world, the world outside, in the internet, etc., the atheists today are very militant. There's a militant atheism since Richard Dawkins published The God Delusion, and the whole genre became a very money-making enterprise. And so the atheists are getting very popular and very powerful the past 10 years. And so there's a whole back and forth of proofs and back and forth, which is an endless debate, as we've spoken about before. But one proof, quote-unquote, I put proof in quotation marks because I don't think it's proof. I think it's utter nonsense. But one proof that's very often given by religious people that the truth of religion can be proved, or proven, I always get mixed up, by virtue of the fact that only with religion will one have a good life. You ever see that? It's a proof that religion is true, because who has good life? Who enjoys a good life? Only religious people. Religious people have a fulfilling life and a serene life, and very often Kirov movements, Kirov organizations that are trying to get people to be religious, they sort of have these Norman Rockwell, you remember Norman Rockwell's calendars with those pictures of, like, you know, the Brady Bunch type of, you know, very wholesome family sitting around the table, around the fireplace with marshmallows, and, you know, all the children look nice and clean and kempt, and people, you know, they want to make people religious. They bring people to Shabbos tables to show how everything is just so perfect, and the children have these angelic faces with little rosy cheeks, and everyone looks exactly in order. You know, they don't bring the potential kiruvies, right? The potential that they're trying to be makarv. They don't bring them to the Jewish home, you know, 20 minutes before candle lighting, where all hell breaks loose, and when there's pandemonium and, you know, four-letter words being thrown around. They bring them to the Shabbos table Friday night, where the gefilte fish is sweet and the chrein is bitter and everything is perfect and everything is just the way it's supposed to be. And so to speak, it's shown that there's a proof religious people have a perfect life, have a utopian life. If you don't have a religious life, if you're not religious, you're going to suffer and it's going to have a lousy, good-for-nothing life. First of all, it's just not true. As we'll speak about, as Rav Soloveitchik is going to speak about, that's just not true. It's moronic, it's ridiculous, and it's false. Many people that are not religious have very fulfilling lives. Many people that are atheists have good lives and fulfilling lives and wholesome lives. And many people that are religious don't have good lives and are could very well often be lousy people and bad people. So it's just not true, first of all. Second of all, it's misleading, because as Rav Soloveitchik said, that's not what religion is about. That's not what religion, that's a characterization. It's a cartoon version of religion. That's what Rav Soloveitchik is making fun of over here. Let's see inside. He's being tongue-in-cheek, the way he's writing over here. This popular ideology contends that the religious experience is tranquil and neatly ordered, tender and delicate. It is an enchanted stream for embittered souls and still waters for troubled spirits. The person who comes in from the field, weary, from the battlefield and campaigns of life. Anyone know where does that phrase come from? Who does it say? He comes in from the field weary, huh? Very good, by Esav. Vayovi Esav min asodah v'hu oyef. He comes in from the field, weary, tired. And so to speak, that's this skewed view, this cartoon, that the secular person has to deal with the real world, right? Even in yeshivas, it used to make me nuts. I hated it when mashgichim, you know, they would speak about, there's the real world, the real world. And then there's yeshiva, whereas we're living in some kind of, you know, bubble, some kind of, you know, extraterrestrial planet, some plane of existence, where we have this, you know, Arcadia, some utopia. And then there's the world outside, and there's this whole view of being in this greenhouse of the yeshiva. The person who comes in from the field weary, from the battlefield and campaigns of life, from the secular domain, which is filled with doubts and fears, contradictions and refutations, clings to religion as does a baby to its mother, and finds in her lap a shelter for his head, the nest of his forsaken prayers, and is there comforted for his disappointments and tribulations. Did everyone got the Bialik reference? He quotes it over here. That's from a poem from Chaim Nachum Bialik. Hachnisini tachat knafeich. Anyone familiar with that poem? It's a poem. Anyone from Israeli knows it from Arik Einstein that just passed away. It's a very famous song. So Bialik's poem, Hachnisini tachat knafeich, is actually a love poem. But the idea of the poem is that person seeks refuge in a female figure that one is looking to be sheltered from the trials and tribulations, from the weariness of life. And so Soloveitchik is using that poem from Bialik to say that this is that caricature of religion, like a baby looks to its mother and find in her lap a shelter for his head, the nest of his forsaken prayers, and is there comforted for his disappointments and tribulations. And again, this is that look that one runs to religion as a nest to find refuge. Says Rav Soloveitchik, this ideology is partially embedded. Now, where does it come from, such a caricature? Anyone that is truly religious knows that it's just not true. It's not so comforting as it's presented, if one lives it in a real way. So he says, this ideology is partially embedded in the most ancient strata of Christianity, which, as we spoke about in the past, which presented religion as an escape from the tribulations of this world. If you remember, we spoke about Augustine. We spoke about the fact that one had to deal with the dangers, with the pitfalls of this world. So they used Platonic philosophy to present religion as an escape, that one is constantly seeking the glorious heavenly realm. Partially rooted in modern pragmatic philosophy, but mainly it stems, religious groups use, again, Rav Soloveitchik says reform and conservative groups, and I say many Orthodox groups, it stems, they use this caricature, this view, from practical utilitarian considerations. Or in modern English, we would say advertising. PR, right? Advertising. What are we feeding? What are those groups feeding off of when they use this caricature of religion as a nest, as a refuge? The advocates of religion wish to exploit, listen to this, the rebellious impulse against knowledge which surges from time to time in the soul of the man of culture. The rebellious impulse against knowledge which surges from time to time in the soul of the man of culture. In other words, that all men of culture, all civilized men, anyone that partakes in society, any one of us that's a part of civilization, that has to live in a day-to-day life and in the world that we live in, there is inherent within our human condition an impulse, a rebellious impulse against knowledge. I'm going to explain in a second what that means. The yearning to be freed from the bonds of culture, that daughter of knowledge, which weighs heavy on man with its questions, doubts, and problems. Culture brings upon man, weighs upon man, brings upon us questions, doubts, and problems. Taking part in culture and civilization brings about automatically within us questions, doubts, and problems, and that therefore that breeds a desire to escape from the turbulence of life to a magical, still, and quiet island, and there to devote oneself to the ideal of naturalness and vitality. Where does this come from? So everyone knows. Who is the one that he's going to make reference to a second that brought to the world this impulse to rebel against knowledge? Who brought about, as we're going to speak about, really this is known as the Romantic movement. The founder of Romanticism was, of course, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The first one towards the end of the 18th century. Rousseau came along as a rebellion against the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment from the time of the 17th century, from the 1600s, already began in the 16th century, when man, so to speak, thought that salvation will come from knowledge. Society, as we know, modern civilization was developed in the 17th and 18th century through the Enlightenment that brought about modern man, as we've spoken about in the past, that modern man felt that that salvation will come from knowledge, that human knowledge, after the discovery of the philosophy of Aristotle, etc., and the development in those centuries, society thought that all of knowledge, all of salvation, all of human fulfillment will come about through knowledge. And it became the very haughty and pompous goal of men that once we figure things out with our mind, everything will be clear. And society slowly developed as becoming this feeling that one had to seek knowledge as the source for all consolation, the consolation of philosophy, etc. The rebellion, the rejection of that was the Romantic movement. Came along Rousseau, and he in his books wrote and said the very opposite. He said that knowledge is a confining factor. Man brought himself into a straitjacket of knowledge, and then all of a sudden people became inhibited. And Romanticism came along and said that in truth, if man is to be happy, happiness is not to be found by knowledge, but by the exact opposite. You know that Rousseau claimed that men were happiest when they were still barbarians, when they were still not civilized. He glorified ancient men that had not yet been bound by the shackles of culture and knowledge, reason, and religion. And he said, if only we could go back to that primitive state when men were living in caves and didn't have any mores, any morals, any ethics binding them, and they were able to do whatever they physically wanted to do. Men were happy back then. This romantic version of man, which was very influential in his time, became even more prevalent in the 60s and 70s. Anyone that remembers the anthropology of Margaret Mead, etc. She came along and it became very famous in the 60s. She went to research in some island in Samoa. And she claimed also that all of our problems, it's very interesting, that all the adolescent issues that we have to deal with, right? The issues of adolescence, the teenage years, which many people still in their 50s and 60s are dealing with, right? All those, you know, the tribulations that Rav Soloveitchik is speaking about and all the facts that we have to struggle and we have to refine ourselves, all the issues that have to be dealt with in adolescence is simply because what modern society puts upon men, what knowledge demands of man, is unnatural. What religion, the inhibitions that religion puts on man, is unnatural. And there's this rebellion that if we would only give in to our physical impulses and we would not be shackled, we wouldn't be bound by what modern society, what civilization, what religion, what the Victorian era did to us, we'd all be happy. We'd all be completely free. We'd run around in little, you know, fig leaf garments, and we'd all be happy. And there was this romantic view that this rebellion against knowledge, rebellion against modern society, be able to just follow the emotions and follow the physical tendencies. So that was the secular version of the Romantic movement, right? The Romantic movement, which brought about a whole change in society and the whole world, so to speak, subscribed to that at some level. The advocates of religion in the early 20th century snatched upon that rebellious impulse against knowledge, that people don't like the trials and tribulations. People are afraid. We don't like having to deal with all these issues. We don't like with having to deal with all these problems that we have and these doubts and questions. And modern man is, at every step of the way, we're faced with all sorts of things having to deal with, whether it's the mortgage, whether it's having to deal with the next door neighbor, all these issues, there's a million things that are on our head. So the advocates of religion came along and said, we have a solution to all your problems, all your suffering, everything you have to deal with. Come to religion. Religion will make bliss, will bring this, your life will be perfect, and everything will be okay. Let's look inside. This Rousseauan ideology left its stamp on the entire Romantic movement from the beginning of its growth and its final tragic manifestations in the consciousness of contemporary man. Now, the tragic manifestations that Salvechik is speaking about, we're going to get to the next page. The Nazi movement was a direct result of the Romantic movement. Germany was the hotbed of Romanticism, and the Nazi movement and the rise of the Nazis, the fact that they were able to rise to power, was a result of the Romantic movement, as we're going to speak about. Therefore, the representatives of religious communities are inclined to portray religion in a wealth of colors that dazzle the eye, as a poetic Arcadia, a realm of simplicity, wholeness, and tranquility. Most of the sermons of revivalists are divided in equal measure between depicting the terrors of hellfire and describing the utopian tranquility that religion can bestow upon man. Right? These versions of religion that either you're going to go to hell, or hell could be a place on earth, hellfire after you die, or hell on earth. Hell is having to deal a secular life of having to make your own decisions. Or these revivalists say, come to religion and you will live a heaven after you die and a heaven on earth. You will have a blissful, tranquil existence. And that which appears in the sermons of these preachers in a primitive, garbled form, at times interwoven with a childish naivete and superficial belief, is refined and purified in the furnace of popular quote-unquote philosophy and theology and becomes transformed into a universal religious ideology which proclaims, if you wish to acquire tranquility without paying the price of spiritual agonies, turn into religion. If you wish to achieve a fine psychic equilibrium without having to first undergo a slow, gradual personal development, turn unto religion. And if you wish to achieve an instant spiritual wholeness and simplicity that need not be forged out of the struggles and torments of consciousness, turn unto religion. That's what they say. Just come to religion and all will be good. It will be simple, it will be tranquil, it will be peaceful. It'll be easy. And now Rav Soloveitchik makes a play on Lech Lecha, the verse that God said to Abraham, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, go out of your home, your land, your father's land. So these preachers, these merchants that are trying to sell religion as some childish toy, as some illusion, as some easy ticket to tranquility, they use that verse that God said to Abraham, and they say it as follows. Get thee out of thy country which is filled with anxiety, anguish, and tension, and from thy birthplace which is so frenzied, raging, and stormy, to the land that is enveloped by the stillness of peace and tranquility, to the Arcadia wherein religion reigns supreme. The leap from the secular world to the religious world cannot be simpler and easier. There is no need for a process of transition with all its torments and upheavals. A person can acquire spiritual tranquility in a single moment. Typical of this attitude is the Christian Science movement, that Rav Soloveitchik says. And I say, typical of this is the year in Israel. Typical of this is what they're selling in the year in Israel. Why does it happen so often that you have people that go to Israel and they go, like, you know, being Mechal Shabbos and doing, you know, 364 out of 365 sins, and they come back like 3 months later with black hats and tzitzis down to the ground? Because very often is painted this picture that we have the panacea, we have the solution for all your issues. Very quickly, in a moment, you could have everything. You could have tranquility, you could have peace of mind, you don't have to deal with the outside world. Easily, you could come and have a simple, easy life. And everything will be good. You'll have a good life. Look at this beautiful family. You'll have a family, you'll have a white picket fence, and everything will be perfect. So first of all, that's why most people, not most, I don't know anyone percentages, but many people after that year, and by the way, but a year in Israel, I don't just mean young men and women. I mean there are people that could be older also and had a, you know, a born-again discovery of Judaism, and they feel that this is going to make everything perfect, and then they have the unfortunate realization that it just doesn't make everything happen and everything perfect all of a sudden, and they all of a sudden realize that it's not so black and white as it was portrayed. So you all know, what's the first, in a Jew's life, at least a male Jew's life, the first thing, how does one enter the covenant with God? The Sfarim say, entering the covenant with God is with the Bris Milah, with the circumcisions. You know what does the Sfarim say about that? What's the message we're saying to the baby? The message we're saying to the baby is, Du darfst gissen Blut zu sein Yid. You want to be a Jew, you have to spill a little blood. Tzara d'yanuka, it's a halachic principle. Tzara d'yanuka. There's a pain for the baby. That's how you enter the covenant. My grandfather, Zecharino Levracha, my grandfather was very, I was very close with all the years. He used to say all the time, and I'm sure many of you have, I don't know, it's not so popular today to say it anymore, but my grandfather used to always say, Shver zu sein Yid. It's hard to be a Jew. And that generation really suffered. They really knew what it meant to hard to be a Jew. Now, there's a very famous anecdote that's told about Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, said that sentence, Shver zu sein Yid, is what destroyed the next generation. That there were so many Jews that were brought up with their parents sighing from anguish. Oh, Shver zu sein Yid, it's hard to be a Jew. And because they heard that, they went off the derech and they said, well, we're not interested in that. Now, if Rav Moshe said it, who am I to argue? That's definitely true. But we have to understand, what was Rav Moshe saying? Rav Moshe, when Rav Moshe Feinstein was negating the Shver zu sein Yid outlook, he wasn't trying to say, like the Christian Science movement or like these stupid preachers that are trying to say that it's easy to be a Jew, because it's not true. What Rav Moshe was saying, he was negating, is that one should say, so Shver zu sein Yid, it's not so easy, it's not just tranquility, it's not Arcadia, it's not still waters, it's not coming from the battlefields of life and just going to some enchanted stream and some enchanted never-never land. Being Jewish is not being Peter Pan. It's not just spending all your days in Never Never Land. No. But Rav Moshe was saying, one should teach your children that even though there's nothing better than it. That's what Rav Moshe was saying. You have to finish the sentence. Of course, of course being a Jew means medav gissen blut. Of course being a Jew means you have to be ready to pour blood out. Being a Jew means you have to struggle and you have to work at it. You have to work, refine your consciousness. It's not possible to be truly religious in 3 months or 3 years or 10 years. It's a constant process. To be a Jew means to constantly wanting to grow. You all know what the Alter Rebbe says, how he learns the Mishnah, the beginning of chapter 47 in Tanya. The Mishnah says in Psochim, which we say in the Haggadah, B'chol dor v'dor chayv adam liras atzmo kil yotz Mitzrayim, in every generation a person has to see himself as if he left Egypt. What does it mean? The Mishnah says every generation you have to see yourself as if you left Egypt. What does it mean every generation? How do we understand on a simple level from the Haggadah? What does it mean every generation? Every generation once a year, the night of the 15th of Nisan, right? What 3 words does the Alter Rebbe add to have a whole new definition of that sentence? Anyone remember? B'chol dor v'dor, u'b'kol yoyim v'yoyim, chayev adam liras atzme kul yotzim in Mitzrayim. 3 words. The Alter Rebbe says, when the Mishnah says in every generation, it doesn't just mean in every generation once a year on the 15th of Nisan. Every generation means every single day. Every day one has to leave Egypt. What does it mean every day one has to leave Egypt? Every day one has to be struggling to become better, to refine oneself. Every day one has to leave the Egypt of yesterday. Every day one has to leave the box of how I understood yesterday what it meant to be a Jew. And we've been speaking about this for weeks already. One has to constantly be going through that struggle within oneself to define what it means to be a Jew. And so therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein wasn't negating the Shver zu sein Yid. Of course the Shver zu sein Yid. It's a Shver zu sein Yid. But yet, nothing could compare to it. There's nothing more beautiful than it. There's nothing more rewarding and fulfilling than being a Jew. That's what Rav Moshe says. You have to finish the sentence. You have to finish the sentence to say that it's worth it. I want to share with you. There's a sefer that's not very well known for some reason. It's a sefer called Binas Nevoinim. The author is also not so well known. The author of the sefer was a Jew called Rav Baruch Yehoshua Yerachmiel Rabinovich. He was the son-in-law of the Holy Mincha Saluzer, the Munkach Rebbe before the war, and the father of the present Munkach Rebbe in Borough Park. He was lived in South America and later on in Petach Tikva, Chulon. So this Rav Baruch Rabinovich, those that are familiar with the Munkach dynasty, he was definitely an interesting figure in Jewish history. He had some interesting views. He went through the Holocaust, and like many people that did, it changed his view on certain issues, particularly Zionism, etc. Whatever. I'm not going to get into detail over here. But he has a very interesting sefer called Binas Nevoinim, the wisdom of the intelligent, where essentially it's a whole book with his reaction or his take on how to relate to the Holocaust. Now, it's very rare that you have a religious person that wrote a book, you know, relating to the Holocaust, to how to relate to the Holocaust. And essentially the point that he says, at least the first few chapters, he says a very interesting thing. He speaks about a great length that in Auschwitz, many people lost their faith. Many people retained their faith. Parenthetically, I always like to quote one of the other great books that speak from a religious person, a religious philosopher about the Holocaust as a reaction, how to relate to the Holocaust, was a book called Faith After the Holocaust by Eliezer Berkowitz. Eliezer Berkowitz is not as well known as some other Jewish philosophers, was a great Jewish philosopher in the 20th century. And he has a book, Faith After the Holocaust. And I always like to say over that he has a beautiful point over there where he says that anyone that was not in the concentration camp has no right to use the Holocaust as either an excuse to lose one's faith or to gain faith. He says, since those that were in the concentration camps, there were those that gained faith, that had strengthened faith from that experience, and there were those that lost their faith from the experience, we, who are, you know, had a nice lunch and a nice dinner, have absolutely no right to use that experience as either a way to gain or lose faith. Those that were in the camps were Eov, were Job. We are only Job's brother. That's what he says. We that were not in the camps are Job's brother, the brothers of Eov. And therefore, we have no right to use that experience as a way to either gain or lose faith. We could only take our shoes off, look at those that went through that experience, those few that are still left alive today. Baruch Shem Nebuchadnezzar Zahel from Bezundet Zvanzig, my grandmother is still one of them. She's 92, still going strong. She was in Auschwitz for 11 months, and she was one of those, she used to tell me all the time, her, my grandfather, that the biggest miracle is not that they survived the camps, but that they retained their faith after the camps. So he says, we have no right, we can't use that experience as a way to gain. We're only Job's brother. Rav Rabinovich, Rav Baruch Rabinovich, in his book, Binas Nevoinim, he says a very interesting thing. In his view, and he wasn't in the concentration camps, but he lost his wife. The Mechseluz's daughter died because of the Pashas, because she was running away from the Nazis, because of that experience. He had a very bad experience. He writes in his book that there were many people that lost their faith and many people retained their faith. And he's coming to say, what was the Evan Abaycha? What was the litmus test? What caused that? What was the reason that some people lost the faith and some people gained the faith? What was the reason? And he says a very interesting thing in his opinion. He brings a pasuk from Eov, from the book of Job. And the pasuk says like this, Hein yiktaluni lo ayachel. Hein yiktaluni. Yes, he will slaughter me. Lo, with a vav, ayachel, yet I will still hope to him, or according to some of Farshim, I will still love him. Hein yiktuluni lo ayachel. Even as he's slaughtering me, I will hope and I will love him. And says Rav Rabinovich, he says, those that used their connection with God as a ticket to a good life lost their faith during the Holocaust. In his opinion, according to his experience, again, he's testifying, those that saw Judaism as a way to have a good life lost their faith in Auschwitz. Those that saw God as a giant ATM machine in the sky, and those that saw Torah as the debit card, the bank card with which you're able to draw from that giant ATM machine in the sky, that saw Torah as just a way of getting stuff, as a way of having a perfect life, those people lost their faith. On the other hand, those that lived a life of hein yiktuluni lo ayachel, even if he will slaughter me, I still love him. Those that the relationship with God was not dependent on a tranquil, beautiful, serene life, they retain their faith. And that's what Rav Soloveitchik is saying over here. A person that has a view, this simplistic view of religion, it's inherently false and it's bound to lead to disaster. Let's read further. It would appear to me that there is no need to explain the self-evident falsity of this ideology. And Rav Soloveitchik says two reasons. Listen carefully. He says there's no need to explain the self-evident falsity of the ideology, and then he goes on to explain it. And he explains it in two ways. Firstly, in this paragraph, he explains because of the danger inherent in the romantic outlook. And the second paragraph, which begins on the bottom, is because he says it's inherently false and deceptive. But let's see what he says. This first paragraph. He says, firstly, the entire romantic aspiration to escape from the domain of knowledge, the rebellion against the authority of objective scientific cognition, which has found its expression in the biologistic philosophies of Birx and Nietzsche, Spengler, Clage and their followers, and the phenomenological, existential, and anti-scientific school of Heidegger and his coterie. Knows that whole school of scientists, of philosophers that are all about the existential romantic view, which I'm going to elaborate in a second. And from the midst of which there arose in various forms the sanctification of vitality and intuition. In other words, the rebellion against objective knowledge. As I mentioned to you, the Romantic movement was a rebellion against the Enlightenment. An impulse, a reflex against the fact that man was being told that all of salvation will come from objective knowledge. Rebellion against that scientific biologistic philosophy was this Romantic view, which arose in various forms, the sanctification of vitality and intuition. What's the Romantic movement? Rav Soloveitchik is going to bring over here a couple of ways to describe what was the Romantic movement glorifying? What were they glorifying? They were sanctifying vitality and intuition. What do we mean intuition? As opposed to what? As opposed to objective scientific knowledge, the Romantic movement glorified intuition. Huh? How you feel? The gut instinct, the gut feeling. How does it make you feel? Anyone been asked that recently? How does it make you feel? And based on the answer is how you should run your life, right? The veneration of instinct, the desire for power, the glorification of the emotional, affective life, and the flowing, surging stream of subjectivity, right? Romanticism means to glorify subjectivity, the flowing, surging stream of subjectivity. Romantic movement means that everyone needs to define for yourself what life is about, what truth is. If anyone wants to ever understand the Romantic movement, the best book, there's a book by Isaiah Berlin called The Roots of Romanticism, where he really goes about and explains, he puts to in a microscope what the Romantic movement was. He actually goes on to say, it's very interesting, he speaks, in his opinion, he says that there was no movement in the past hundreds of years that have more of an impact on the psyche of Western man. And he goes through a whole thing to try to explain that essentially we're children of both worlds, the Enlightenment and Romanticism, and how much of modern history is a result of Romanticism. But essentially what it is, the idea of Romanticism is this glorification of emotion, of subjectivity, and of passion. Venerating martyrdom. It doesn't even matter what it is, what the cause is that you're fighting for. As long as you really believe in it with passion, it's holy. It's actually interesting. He goes on and he says, by way of example, he takes two philosophers that spoke about Muhammad. He says that Voltaire, now Voltaire could never have been accused of being a religious man. Voltaire was an atheist par excellence, but Voltaire was an Enlightenment. He was a philosopher of the Enlightenment. And he has a whole essay about Muhammad where he describes him in the most disgusting terms as a good for nothing and lousy and filthy. And he says, 50 years later was another philosopher called Carlyle, who was a romantic philosopher. And he, who was a Christian, glorifies Muhammad. I just want to read to you a quote over here. He says, he calls Muhammad a fiery mass of life cast up from the great bosom of nature herself, a man of blazing sincerity and power, and therefore to be admired. Not because he agreed with anything that Muhammad said, but only why? Because he believed in it. Because he was authentic. The cult of authenticity. Romanticism is the glorification of what you authentically believe in. What you really believe in to be true. What you feel to be true. And therefore the Romantics espoused that if you're taught anything objective, scientific, it's inherently not real. Because you haven't experienced it. You haven't felt it emotionally. Now, I need to make a disclaimer. I don't necessarily agree with everything I'm saying tonight. Rav Soloveitchik was anti-romantic. I'm not. I think there within the Hasidic schools, there's a lot of place for romanticism, but that's beyond the scope of tonight's class. I'm just explaining what Rav Soloveitchik is saying. But in Rav Soloveitchik's opinion, one has this flow, this flowing stream, this surge of romanticism, of venerating the natural instincts of man and venerating subjectivity and everyone finding for yourself something that you could believe in. And of course, everyone understands that that's a very adolescent, teenage way that if my parents are teaching it to me, it must be wrong, right? I can't, you know, what's the phrase? Leave me alone, let me make my own mistakes, right? Let me discover for myself what's true, what's real, what I feel to be authentic, what I feel to be sincere. Whether it's actually objectively true or not, it doesn't matter. I have to believe in it with a passion. If I'm passionate about it, then it's true. Then it's real. Leo Beck, who was a German rabbi beginning of the 20th century, he has a whole essay called Romantic Religion, where essentially, like Rav Soloveitchik, they both nursed from the same teachers. Leo Beck has an essay, Romantic Religion, where essentially he says that Christianity is a religion of romanticism. Judaism is the opposite. Judaism doesn't believe in romanticism. Again, I don't agree with this necessarily, but he writes, listen to what he says. Leo Beck writes that for the romantic, everything dissolves into feeling. Everything becomes mere mood. Everything becomes subjective. Fervently, the romantic enjoys the highest delight and the deepest pain day after day. He enjoys the most enchanting and the most sublime. He enjoys his wounds and the streaming blood of his heart. He experiences their many echoes and stands higher in his estimation than life with its tasks, right? He experiences the many echoes and higher estimation of life more than the tasks of life itself. For tasks always establish a bond with harsh reality. The romantic is not looking for a bond with reality. The romantic is looking to experience the estimation of life, the understanding, the beauty of life. Anyone that knows, there's a famous poem by John Keats, the great romantic poet, called Ode on a Grecian Urn. Remember the poem Ode on a Grecian Urn? Ode on a Grecian Urn is that John Keats described that he looks at an urn, which has in a different scenes from a Greek play, from a Greek drama, a romantic play, of love and war and drama, and he says, heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Because for the romantic, melodies that can be heard, realities of life, might be sweet, but they can't compare to the sweetness of what? Of unheard melodies, of pretending. And from this, says the Beck says, from this, from the bond of harsh reality, the romantic is in flight. He does not want to wrestle for his blessing, but to experience it, abandoning himself, devoid of will, to what spells salvation and bliss. Everything, thinking and poetry, knowledge and illusion, all here and all above, flows together in a foaming poem, into a sacred music, into a great transfiguration. In the end, the floods close over the soul, while all and nothing become one. The romantic lives in a fantasy world of just trying to experience the passion and is not interested in experiencing the harsh bonds of reality itself. And therefore, if Soloveitchik says, this romantic aspiration is dangerous, why? Look inside. The glorification of the emotional effect of life and the flowing, surging stream of subjectivity, the lavishing of extravagant praise and the Faustian type. Everyone remembers Faust? Considered to be one of the textbooks of Romanticism is the book by Goethe, the great German Romantic poet Wolfgang Goethe, called Faust. What's the Faustian type? What's the idea of the book Faust? Those that are willing to exchange everything for the beauty of the here and now. Faust was a doctor that made a deal, that signed a pact with the devil, that he was willing to give his soul to the devil. He was willing to experience everything. He didn't care the consequences, as long as he was able to experience the beauty and the passion of the here and now. That's the Faustian type, one that does not look at what's going to be tomorrow. There are many songs about that, right? Don't think about tomorrow, just enjoy the now. That's the Faustian type. And the Dionysian personality, Dionysius was the Greek god of intoxication and ecstasy. Says Rav Soloveitchik, etc., etc. This whole view have brought complete chaos and human depravity to the world. And let the events of the present era be proof. Halachic Man was written in 1944. You understand that the Nazi movement, Hitler was able to come to power because the German people for 100 years were completely inundated with the romantic view. The romantic view eventually is able to bring about, it doesn't matter objective knowledge of right and wrong and ethics, that's not the deciding factor. What's the deciding factor? What should one base one's life on? Beauty, utopia, Arcadia. What seems to be, what feels to be right? And that brought about the nationalistic pride, that brought about the Nazi movement, etc. It didn't matter objective feeling anymore, objective knowledge. It's the feeling, it's the pride in one's nation, in one's homeland, etc. Deutschland über alles, the fatherland over all else. This feeling of the beauty of the homeland, of what I believe in what's... What did Nietzsche say? Man believes in what seems to be spoken with great passion and what's believed in. Hitler, Yamach Shmei, was able to buy the entire German people because in his speeches was pure romance. It didn't matter whether the things he said actually made sense or not. It was so passionate. It was so pure, it seemed to be. It seemed to be so right. It felt to be so pride. Such pride was felt in his speeches. The individual who frees himself from the rational principle and who casts off the yoke of objective thought will in the end turn destructive and lay waste the entire created order. Therefore, it is preferable. Now listen to this. Now here's a real misnagit speaking. You'll forgive me for saying so, but here if Soloveitchik betrays the fact that he's a real misnagit. It is preferable that religion should ally itself with the forces of clear logical cognition as uniquely exemplified in the scientific method, even though at times the two might clash with one another, rather than pledge its troth, in other words, to engage itself, to be clouded, mysterious ideologies that grope in the dark corners of existence. Now, I must say that even though Rav Soloveitchik says this over here, it's a little hard to believe that, I mean, that he himself was such a cold, logical, scientific type. It's not exactly true in a lot of his... It could be that that Rav Soloveitchik would have liked to believe in this cold, logical, scientific method. But of course, he says that it's preferable that religion should betroth, should engage itself to the scientific method, rather than pledge its troth to the beclouded, mysterious ideologies that grope in the dark corners of existence, unaided by the shining light of objective knowledge, and believe that they have penetrated to the secret core of the world. Or Rabbi Yerucham, and that's what Rav Soloveitchik is saying in these two sentences, Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz from Mir, the Mashgiach of Mir, when he used to make fun of Chassidism, of Chassidim, Rabbi Yerucham Levavitz used to say, Krich nisht derein mit the malachim. Don't scratch around with the angels, right? Don't pledge your troth. How does he say over here? Unaided by the shining light of objective knowledge and believe that penetrate the secret core of the world in these mysteries of romantic, you know, spirituality. So basically, the first thing Rav Soloveitchik is saying is that there's a danger in the romantic movement and romantic impulse, which we don't have to explain. Rav Soloveitchik is saying is very true. First of all, the ultimate danger, because all totalitarian movements of the 20th century were immediate results of the romantic movement, of this seeking passion, seeking power, glorification of power. Nietzsche and his glorification of the will to power, of the Superman, of the survival of the fittest, and glorifying, sanctifying those that have power, those that believe in themselves, that all comes from the Romantic movement. That's on a large scale, the danger of Romanticism. On a small scale, what's the danger of Romanticism? I don't think I need to explain. In our daily lives, in today's society, we're constantly bombarded and challenged by the Romantic movement's children, offspring. The Romantic movement's offspring is, I don't know where even to begin. I don't think I need to. I think you all understand. That we're constantly told and we're seduced to go after feeling, what makes us feel good, what meets the beauty that meets our eye. These are the type of things that are very dangerous. Now again, as I'm going to speak about Mitzvah Shem next week, we're going to get into, there are definitely within Chassidus, there are schools that very much do ascribe to certain aspects of the Romantic movement. I'm going to speak about it next week. And therefore we have to understand that there definitely is a place for authenticity and a place for passion, etc. It's not so black and white like Soloveitchik seems to be saying in this paragraph. But what we do have to take from it is to understand that there is a danger of rejecting objectivity. There's a danger in this looking at this seeking tranquility and seeking just to go after passion, rebelling against objective knowledge. One has to hold on to objective knowledge. And Mitzvah Shem, when we put the two together, the mind and the heart, is when we're going to actually be able to encounter God in all His glory. Mitzvah Shem will continue next week.